A few days ago, Governor Branstad signed into law a bill making substantial revisions to the state's HIV criminalization law. This hour, an Iowan who was convicted and served time under the old law.
9 months in jail were awful. I mean, I went for I don't know how long without any heat during like one of the coldest winters in Iowa's history. I had frostbite on my hands.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In 2009, Nick Rhodes was sentenced to 25 years in prison for having sex with a man who says Rhodes didn't first disclose that he had HIV. In the first half hour, we'll talk with Nick Rhodes. Then, we'll get a long-view perspective on the AIDS epidemic and advances in treatment by talking with infectious disease specialist Dr. Jeffrey Meyer of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Meyer has been treating patients with HIV and AIDS since the early days of the epidemic. That's all coming up this hour. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Nick Rhodes is my guest in this first half hour. In 2009, Rhodes was convicted under Iowa's HIV criminal transmission law. His crime? Having sex without first disclosing he had HIV. A condom was used during the sexual encounter, and the man Rhodes had sex with did not contract the virus. Nevertheless, Rhodes was sentenced to 25 years in prison after spending 9 months in the Black Hawk County Jail. After 4 months in an Iowa correctional facility, Rhodes was resentenced. His 25 years was reduced to the time he had served, plus 5 years of supervised probation. He was also required to be registered as a sex offender for the rest of his life. On May 30, 2014, just a few days ago, Iowa Governor Terry Branstad signed into law a bill making substantial revisions to the state's HIV criminalization law. Nick Rhodes joins me this half hour from our studio in Des Moines. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the start of your story. June 2008, you had sex with a man, a one-time encounter. What happened after that?
Shortly thereafter, I had made multiple attempts to contact this individual, which are, you know, part of the evidence record in the court case.
To tell him what?
To tell him about my status. Granted, you know, a little too late. However, I did make attempts to do so. Unbeknownst to me, at that time, he had already been in contact with law enforcement, and there was an investigation that had started, and so he wasn't responding to any of my emails or invitations, you know, to try to get together and, you know, have a civil conversation about what had happened. And so subsequently, the final piece of the puzzle that put me over the line and the arrest warrant was issued was after a telephone conversation was recorded between Mr. Plendel and myself, unbeknownst to me, where I very directly and honestly, you know, admitted about my HIV status being positive, but also indicating that my viral load was undetectable, trying to trying to explain the science of, you know, what it means to be undetectable. And
you were on antiviral drugs, so your viral load, I guess is the term, was very low, right?
Correct. They term it as undetectable. And then you add a, you know, undetectable viral loads reduce the risk of transmission to 96% or more. So it's very significant. And then when you add a condom to it, some people call it the belt and suspenders approach. The risk of actual transmission is, according to Dr. Meyer and other medical professionals, quote, zero or very, very near zero.
Dr. Jeffrey Meyer will be with us in our second half a little bit more about the HIV/AIDS epidemic. That what were your thoughts when you were charged, when you were arrested?
I was stunned. And, of course, terrified, and, you know, there was just shock. And immediately I was thinking about what this was going to put my family through and whether or not I was going to be able to endure what was to come. You know, having one's HIV status become public knowledge and, you know, strewn about the media and, you know, your face on all of these different you know, media websites or newspapers, so on and so forth. You know, it's kind of a hot topic. You know, you're dealing with HIV, mm-hmm. Sometimes homosexuality, and, you know, it becomes a sex offense. So this is, you know, this is very sensational news.
What did you do then in the becoming immediately aware of the arrest that was impending?
I guess what could be termed a nervous breakdown. I just felt it was more than I was going to be able to deal with. And so I did attempt suicide prior to my arrest. After the arrest warrant was issued, I was then put in an acute psychiatric care ward at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, where I, you know, was kind of a staging area for jail and what was to come. And I was there for 7 weeks with intensive inpatient medication management and psychotherapy to prepare me for what I was, you know, having to face.
Before you were convicted, I guess before you pled guilty, we can talk about that in a moment, you were held for 9 months in the Black Hawk County Jail. What was that like?
It was hellish. I was in solitary confinement for multiple weeks, you know, kind of transferred back and forth between maximum, depending on how full solitary became, you know, receiving medication through a slot in my door, food.
So this is not just a single cell. This is no windows, no anything.
There was a window that was opaque. And other than that, it was a single cell. And mm-hmm. You received 1 hour per day to use the telephone and to shower. And, you know, if you needed to mail a letter, those sorts of things. And otherwise, you were back in your cell, and there were no clocks. And so I spent a significant amount of time in solitary, catching up on my reading. And finally, I was transferred to the maximum security portion of the Black Hawk County Jail, where I spent the next, I would say, about, you know, 8+ months of my time incarcerated, you know, because I had a $250,000 bond. And it wasn't right until the end before I was transferred to Oakdale Classification Center that, you know, I was offered to move to general population, but, you know, it was about a week before I was going to be moved. So
you couldn't pay the $250,000, and that's why you were in prison. Take us up to the time of, I guess there was no trial. You pleaded guilty. Why?
At the advice of my counsel at the time, he was not familiar with this law, and very few attorneys in Iowa are familiar with the law. I mean, more and more it's becoming something that attorneys are aware of and, you know, becoming more knowledgeable about. But this particular attorney had, you know, no knowledge of it, and based on, I suppose, his best recommendation, based on his experience and professional opinion, he thought that pleading guilty would possibly, you know, result in a suspended sentence or reduced sentence or, you know, something, some sort of plea bargain. However, that did not happen, and I received the full, you know, penalty of 25 years in prison with a lifetime sex offender registry and all the things that go along with that.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think pleading guilty was the wrong move at that time? What would be, if you were to make the case now, your argument for innocence?
Well, there were a few elements there. You know, there was a bit of a technicality when the judge did the sentencing. According to my attorneys with Lambda Legal, it's been informed to me that there were procedures that were supposed to be followed with, I guess, what's called a mens rea, you know, pleading, where if they're discussing intimate contact, it's a very broad term. Intimate contact in itself can be interpreted in several different ways. And the judge, when, you know, he asked me if I had engaged in intimate contact without disclosing my status, he didn't go into greater detail of what, you know, that was. Beyond that, my attorney did not, he just didn't know enough about the law to, I think, adequately advise me. And I certainly didn't know by pleading guilty, I was going to be a sex offender for the rest of my life. That was never brought up. And so I took his advice and was hoping for a plea bargain, and somehow, you know, by accepting responsibility, 100% that, you know, perhaps there would be mercy from the court, but that did not happen.
After 4 months, I believe, in a correctional facility here in Iowa, your 25-year sentence was reduced to the time you had served plus 5 years of supervised probation. What was life like once you got out? You had to wear an anklet, a GPS anklet, and you, as you just mentioned, you were registered as a sex offender.
That's correct. I had to, every 3 months, I have to go register as a sex offender, as I am on the Tier 3 category sex offender, which is considered the most dangerous, which requires me to register every 3 months versus, you know, other sex offenders for more violent crimes or, you know, pedophilia, et cetera, have, you know, a less frequency required for registering. I had to take polygraph tests every 6 months.
What was that about?
It was the first polygraph took about 2 hours, and they call that a life history polygraph, where they went over every detail of my sexual experiences and my life from, you know, forever up until the point that I was convicted and sitting in that chair. And, you know, they were asking questions such as how many sex partners in my entire life I had had and what types of sexual activities I engaged in with regards to group activities or sexual props or sex with corpses or bestiality or sex with children or fantasizing about children or sex in public places. Have you frequented adult bookstores or things of, you know, pornographic nature? How often a week did I masturbate? All these sorts of things that were extremely personal and invasive. And
what was the overall aim of that? To test whether you were lying before or to see if you'd been reformed in their eyes?
Well, it's my understanding that I also had to take several psychological tests with a psychologist at the probation office and, you know, the MMPI and some other, you know, tests that were pretty extensive. And I think what they wanted to do was, you know, take this life history polygraph, take these personality, you know, psychological tests and the results of them. And once all of the data had come in, then the three people, you know, most influential in the probation office that, you know, have any impact on developing sex offender treatment programs for sex offenders within the state of Iowa, then they would determine the, you know, they would tailor the sex offender treatment program for the offender. So, yeah, it was evaluation.
Nick Rhodes is my guest. If you've just joined us, he was convicted under Iowa's HIV criminal transmission law in 2009, sentenced to 25 years in prison, and listed as a sex offender. So you are currently a sex offender, listed as a sex offender?
Yes, sir, wearing an ankle bracelet as we speak.
You wear an ankle bracelet 24/7?
Yes, sir.
Where did you grow up, Nick?
I grew up on a farm just outside of Waverly on the border of Plainfield, Iowa. Holstein Farm, a pretty quiet area. So definitely kind of I guess I was at one time a farm boy, you know, doing all of the things that, you know, people on the farm do.
What did this episode, this whole thing, do to your relationship with your family, your parents, your community there?
My mother was the only person, and my stepfather, they were the only two people who stood by me. You know, they were steadfast supporters of me, and trust me, it has not been easy for them, not just because of what I've been going through and, you know, the pain that has caused them, just seeing, you know, their family member, their son, hurting, but also this has affected me, you know, my mental health, and, you know, when my mental health is off kilter, then, you know, it affects them as well. So I think there's a certain amount of embarrassment involved and, you know, just disbelief. It's been extremely, extremely hard for them, and they have endured 5 or 6 now long, arduous years, but they've stuck with me. My father, on the other hand, and I'm not, you know, speaking negatively about him in any way, when I was in jail prior to sentencing, for whatever reason, it became too much for him to want to be involved in, and so we have we cut off communications at that time and haven't spoken since. And that was late 2008, early 2009, and his side of the family kind of, you know, followed suit, and so that was very painful for me.
Recently, Iowa Governor Branstad signed into law a bill revising substantial revisions to the state's HIV criminalization law. What does that mean for you?
Me personally, it means quite a bit, actually. There's retroactive language in there. There's a clause that specifically has language that will take me off of the sex offender registry or anyone convicted under the previous statute, 709C. So that in itself will change my life dramatically because, you know, I recently tried to get a move to California. I could not because the residence I was seeking was within 300 feet of a school. But I can now visit my nieces and nephews without supervision by their parents. I can get this GPS ankle bracelet off very soon, I'm told, by my probation officer.
Do you know when?
I'm specifically and most definitely by July 1st, but there is rumor that it could come off when I get back to the Waterloo area on the following Monday. So we might be lucky. We're going to see.
Nick, these criminalization laws, these HIV criminalization laws, were put in place to protect the public, to prevent cases where someone with HIV knowingly exposed others to the virus and did not disclose their HIV status before a sexual encounter. There have been examples of people, well, did this in a 2010 case, an HIV-positive man arrested in Indiana for knowingly and intentionally exposing more than 100 women to the virus over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we have this revision to Iowa's law, are you satisfied with the law as it is now, that it strikes the balance between protecting the public but not doing what it did in your case, which many people would agree was too extreme?
I personally think that the law is more than adequate. There's never anything with regards to perfect legislation. We seek the best that we can. Compromises obviously have to be made. We're, you know, when we were lobbying, specifically Tammy Haught, the community organizer for CHAIN, the advocacy group that really spearheaded this issue, they, you know, had to deal with luckily we had a Democratic-controlled Senate, but the House was controlled by Republicans. And I'm not trying to imply this is a partisan issue, because I think the evidence shows that Iowa is the first state to demonstrate that we can get behind the change of these laws without partisan bickering, because of the evidence that is now available to us indicating that these laws discourage testing. They keep people from accessing care, and ultimately, they, you know, they perpetuate the virus, you know, being passed along at an increased rate. And especially at this time, you know, Iowa, with the new HIV/AIDS strategy that President Obama issued, which, you know, is what we wanted. However, low incidence states like Iowa got their funding cut for prevention and care by up to 65% to 70%, and those funds were reallocated to, you know, states like California. So we really have to be innovative. But these decisions to move forward with this bill were not knee-jerk. They were not based on hunches. You know, there really was evidence indicating that we needed new strategies to try to help to reduce infections. And we firmly believe that we can anticipate a market improvement, not overnight, but soon enough in public health in the state of Iowa. And I think that's paramount. And I think that any politician or individual, any citizen, regardless of how they feel about people living with HIV in their state or whatever preconceptions they might have, you have to be able to get behind the public health issue. And I believe that the unanimous support in the Senate and the House demonstrates that Iowa is a leader in doing that. And by having a Republican governor sign this into law, citing the public health aspect, is quite extraordinary, and I'm very proud of that.
We've got a couple minutes left. Do you think that this revision by Iowa has an influence wider in the country, in other states where there are other cases, perhaps similar to yours?
I think there will be more measurable evidence of that. I think this is going to be a ripple effect. I think that Iowa is now a droplet in a very still pond, and I'm very much hoping that, you know, the ripples affect other states, and no one wants to be the first. And for us to be the first with unanimous support, like I said, Democrats, Republicans alike, Republican governor, I hope that other states can say, well, Iowa did it, we can do it. And so I hope that we will make it easier for other states to combat these laws.
How often do you run into people, or have you run into people, who just aren't sympathetic to what happened to you? You broke the law. You did not disclose your status before having sex with that man, and you got punished for it according to our law.
I will say that I do not claim that what happened, that I am blameless. Absolutely not. Not disclosing your status is not acceptable. However, I think you have to decide what is morally wrong and what is criminal. And if something is criminal, what is appropriate punishment for the circumstances that led to a conviction? And forgive me, can you please repeat the question?
Well, just talking to your critics, the people who you got what you deserved.
Well, I think that they're wrong. I think that sometimes you have to be in the shoes of the person who is experiencing this. I think if you really take an objective view of circumstances and you compare it perhaps to other laws on the books that citizens support, vehicular homicide, for example, I killed someone in a car accident, you know, maybe drinking and driving, the penalty would have been likely less severe than what happened to me. Now, if you think that practicing safe sex, taking care of yourself, getting tested, not passing on a virus to someone deserves more punishment than someone being irresponsible enough to get intoxicated behind the wheel and kill someone, that just does not make sense to me. And so these critics, I think they really need to kind of open their eyes a little bit more.
We have about 30 seconds left. Will you continue to work with your legal team to try to get an appeal to your conviction?
Actually, we are waiting for a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court any day now. So
the decision on the question of your appeal?
Of my appeal, yes, for post-conviction relief. So we are, you know, praying for a positive outcome.
Okay. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us, Nick Rhodes, for coming into our Des Moines studio, convicted under Iowa's HIV criminal transmission law in 2009, sentenced to 25 years in prison. Nick Rhodes, thank you very much for sharing all of this with us. We can better understand.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Coming up, when we return from a short break, we'll get a long-view perspective on the AIDS-HIV epidemic, advances in treatment by talking with infectious disease specialist Dr. Jeffrey Meyer of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Meyer has been treating patients with HIV and AIDS since the early days of the epidemic, and we invite your questions. 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Jeffrey Meyer, talking about a long perspective on the AIDS-HIV epidemic. When we return, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.